We'll now begin with our first case, United States against Rankin. Counsel for appellant.
May it again please the court. Tenant miser for hospitalman third class, James Rankin. 20 years ago, President Ronald Reagan said that the 9 most terrifying words in the English language were, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help." Now, President Reagan was talking about farming that August afternoon at the Illinois State Fair, but he could have just as easily been talking about the government practice in this case. Because the government argues that the documents admitted in this case were generated to ensure that appellant was properly paid and that to ensure that he was not lost at sea. Remember, they're from the government and they're here to help. The framers of the Bill of Rights shared President Reagan's distrust of government, particularly when the government was involved in the production of evidence with an eye towards trial. And the documents in this case are the product of an investigation focused on the criminal misconduct of appellant. According to the Military Personnel Manual 1600-40, there's a 10-step investigation that is conducted every time a service member begins a period of unauthorized absence. The first step, according to that article, is to list the absentee on the morning muster report or absentee report for accountability purposes. The second step is then to provide the absentee report to the dispersing so that the service member's pay can be terminated. Only after completing this investigation does the command generate a page 13 and then later a page 6. The page 13 comes within 24 hours of the absence, and if an absence is over 24 hours, the page 6 is generated. That's important because in Davis versus Washington, the Supreme Court provided further indicators for this court of when and or when not a statement is testimonial. And one of the important indicators is whether a statement describes past events or merely events as they are actually happening. And it's important here because as this court found in United States versus Magyari, the drug litigation package and the notations that were being made on the test results as they were coming off of the machines were being made as they actually happened, not describing past events. And so where the drug lab report at issue in Magyari is not testimonial because it was not the result of an investigation that was focused on the criminal misconduct of the accused, these documents plainly are. And the analogy in the drug context would be a command directed your analysis, where the command has probable cause to believe that there is a controlled substance in this individual's blood, and they send that report to the drug lab. That would be testimonial, and that's analogous to the issue that we have here today. The non-testimonial document that was presented is, in fact, the muster report. And the muster report is generated across the fleet in the Marines and in the Navy, and that is the battalion sergeant major standing in front of the company, the battalion, whatever formation it is, and noting that he's supposed to have 146 service members present that morning. He has 142. And when he makes that notation, he doesn't know that Seaman Johnson is actually at a dental appointment that morning from his section chief. He doesn't know that perhaps another individual is on leave, or that HM3 Rankin that morning had begun a period of unauthorized absence. That document is not generated for later use at trial. That is not what we have here. The document that we have here is 2 or 3 steps removed from that document, because from the muster report is generated the absentee report, which then, as I mentioned, goes to the dispersing office. That absentee report is then used to generate the page 13, which you have in this case prosecution exhibits for identification 2 and 3, which were not ultimately admitted into evidence, and from those documents then come the page 6 that you have in this case. So by the time that the declarants of these documents generated these documents, they were fairly certain that a crime had been committed, and they were recording that fact to later bear testimony at an eventual court-martial of appellant.
Counsel, then, would this be a correct summarization of your position that the muster report that's generated to document that a particular individual is not present at a particular place and time can be introduced into a court-martial as non-testimonial evidence without violating Crawford?
I believe so, yes, Your Honor. Now, it would depend in the individual case on how the muster report was taken, but the average muster report is going to be just as I described it, which is a routine, normal document that's generated every morning on every ship and in every unit across the fleet, and it is not generated for prosecution purposes, but for accountability purposes.
Then, if a muster report can be introduced, can a properly authenticated muster report provide the basis for an extract that is then included in other documents? And if they are properly authenticated along the chain, can those documents be introduced without violating Crawford?
If that showing had been made, and it was not made in this case, Your Honor, the government's foundation witness, Ms. Slocum, could only offer speculation as to where these documents, where the information was obtained in these documents. She believes that it's from the page 13. She believes that it's from the muster report. That's on page 270 and 273 of the record, and numerous other places where she actually cites the muster report. But
well, what I'm trying to figure out then is, do we have in this case, at its heart, a Crawford problem in terms of testimonial hearsay being introduced, or do we have initially an authentication issue, that is, information that is at least potentially non-testimonial, but a question's arisen as to whether it's properly authenticated as it's been extracted and placed into subsequent documents?
Well, Your Honor, I think that you have a Crawford problem, and that is because on page 228, I've already mentioned 270 and 273, where Ms. Slocum testifies that this information comes from both the page 13 and the muster report. On page 228, she describes what the page 13 is, and the purpose of the page 13 is to explain possible reasons, Agent 3 Rankin's possible reasons for going UA. And if you look at prosecution exhibits 2 and 3 in this case, they detail how appellant has cleaned out his bank account, how he's taken his picture down from the command board, a number of factors that are purporting to explain why he's gone UA. His girlfriend's address, his wife's address, they list all of that information on those two documents. And the documents in this case are taken not from the purely perhaps admissible muster report. They're also taken from the page 13, according to Ms. Slocum.
And to what extent was that material from the page 13 that you've described as beyond the muster report introduced into evidence against the appellant in this case?
Your Honor, those facts were not introduced into evidence in this case from prosecution exhibits 2 and 3.
Okay. So that's then my next question. If you have subsequent documents, let's assume they are properly authenticated, something you're not conceding in this case. And there's a variety of extraneous information on those documents, extraneous in terms of whether someone was present or absent. If the military judge then precludes the introduction of that information and only allows the information that's from a properly authenticated extract of a morning report or a muster report, is that information then creating a problem under Crawford?
I believe that it does, Your Honor, because you have to look to the reason that secondary document was being created, according to Crawford. And under Crawford, they are making a permanent record of that information to later serve as prosecution exhibits 5, 6, 10, 11 in this case, even though the original document itself was perhaps non-testimonial.
Even if that extract is properly authenticated?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
Why?
Because the government is producing evidence in this case. Even if they're using non-testimonial hearsay, they're generating evidence. They're trying to produce a document that can later serve as a permanent record of that unauthorized absence. And there is no reason why the government in this case couldn't just produce, in fact, the original muster report without having to go through 8 days later, in this case, of making this permanent record that was later going to be introduced as prosecution exhibit 6.
What if there is a reason that the muster report is not available?
Your Honor, I believe that that would depend on the facts of each individual case, but in this case, we don't have that that evidence before the court. What we have is we know that there was a muster report, we know that there was an absentee report, we know that there were page 13s, and then the government wants to bring none of those documents into evidence. They want to bring a fourth document, which is in this case, Prosecution Exhibit 6, the page 6.
And last question. We don't have before us in this appeal, although it was raised at trial, a challenge to the authentication of the documents. Under those circumstances, why should we not proceed on the basis that the documents for purposes of this appeal were properly authenticated?
You should, Your Honor. You should proceed on those grounds. The problem here is not that these were taken from properly authenticated documents. It's the purpose behind generating this secondary document.
So before we leave that, I want to focus on the scope of our review, not in terms of the standard, but what it is we're reviewing. At this stage, for purposes of this appeal, the question then before us is, if we have a properly authenticated document containing an extract of a muster report, and that document as a whole was prepared for the reasons other than the recording of the absence, that is, for the various reasons you've set forth in your brief, is that a problem under Crawford if the military judge extracts all the information other than or excludes all the information other than the report of the muster?
Yes, Your Honor, it would be a problem under Crawford.
No, I just want to make sure that that's what we're looking at here. That is, we're looking at a muster report, the extract of which is properly authenticated and put in subsequent documents. Those documents have a variety of purposes. Those other purposes have not been brought before the members. And the defense position is, because those documents were created for other purposes, the fact that we have a properly authenticated muster report doesn't remove the Crawford problem.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
That's correct.
The CCA identifies a number of factors as to why they didn't consider this to be testimonial under Crawford. Could you go through each of those factors and identify what other factors may be relevant in identifying testimonial evidence?
Well, Your Honor, the three factors that are relevant.
And then when you've got your factors set up, we'll go through the actual documents and indicate how they apply to each document.
Yes, Your Honor. The factors that are relevant are those provided by Davis v. Washington, at least three further indicators of whether or not a document is testimonial: whether it describes past events, the function or role of the declarant, which is important because in Crawford, the court discussed that a casual remark to an acquaintance would not be testimonial, and in Davis, they further suggest that the Confrontation Clause cannot be evaded by having a note-taking policeman recite the unsworn testimony of the declarant in the open court. So the role declarant plays is also important. And then the final factor that the court mentions in Davis is the formality of the statement. Again, a casual remark to an acquaintance or the issue in Davis, the cry for help in a 911 call is not testimonial, whereas you have the formal process dealing with Sylvia Crawford's confession at the police station. And I think that is analogous to this case.
And what about the factors the CCA cited, including the primary purpose test, which is also taken from Davis?
That's right, Your Honor. Although the court's decision came out several months before Davis, so it looks like the CCA beat the Supreme Court to the punch on Crawford v. Washington.
Supreme Court's following the CCA.
That's right. That's what it would appear to be here, Your Honor. The primary purpose test certainly is one of the factors in Davis, and the primary purpose of these documents was to later serve as evidence.
Hang on. We'll get to that in a second, but is primary purpose, in your view, part of the fabric of determining whether something is testimonial or not?
It is, in fact, Your Honor.
Okay, and what about the the largely objective in nature.
Well, Your Honor,
you were focusing on whether it was contemporaneous or not, and the CCA seems to be focusing on whether it's largely objective in nature.
Your Honor, it is entirely irrelevant whether an observation is objective in nature as to whether it will be testimonial or not testimonial, because you could have the policeman, as happened in Hammond v. Indiana, the second part of the Davis opinion, objectively record what he saw or what took place in the Hammond household that evening. And so I believe the reliance on the objective nature of the statements does not further this analysis at all.
Okay, now, have you laid out your factors?
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you mind going through each of the documents and indicating and relating those factors to the documents?
Certainly, Your Honor. Prosecution Exhibit 5 is a letter from Lieutenant D.E. Gibson to appellant's mother, created July 26, 1993, 13 days after appellant's initial absence. And so it certainly describes past events. The role of the declarant in that case is critical. It's a lieutenant from appellant's chain of command, which relates also to the third factor, formality of the statement. This is a formal notification to appellant's mother that he has begun a period of desertion. And the primary purpose of this letter is not for pay, it's not for accounting, it's to assist in the apprehension and later prosecution of appellant. And so that document is testimonial. Prosecution Exhibit 6.
And you determine that based on the text of the letter?
Yes, Your Honor.
I understand, that's your conclusion. I just want to make sure I understand how you get there.
Yes, Your Honor.
And what about the CCA's argument? Now, I understand you discount this factor, but they say it's largely objective in nature. You don't agree that's a factor, but do you agree that this is largely objective? You just don't agree that that's a factor, or do you disagree with how they've applied that factor?
I disagree that that's a factor, Your Honor. The Supreme Court has never, either in Crawford, Davis, or Hammond, mentioned this objective nature of statements factor that the court uses.
Okay.
If I can go on then to Prosecution Exhibit 6, which is Action 1, page 6 from H&1 Parsons. It was created July 21st, 1993, 8 days after the absence, so it again describes past events. The role of the declarant there is hospital corpsman who's working on behalf of the command to document this criminal activity, and we know that it's a formal statement. It has attestation on the bottom signed by H&1 Parsons. Primary purpose behind this document is to serve as a permanent record of unauthorized absence at appellant's court-martial when and if he is ever apprehended.
Is there any other purpose to this document?
Sure, Your Honor, and that's where the primary purpose comes in, to prove in this case that this document is prosecutorial. There could be a pay purpose behind this, and the court, lower court, seizes on this. There could be, there is no accountability purpose behind this document created 8 days after. It could later serve to correct appellant's pay. It could later serve to administer the proper EAOS date to the appellant. But the principal purpose that they're creating this is to later serve as prosecution exhibit.
How do you determine if something is the primary purpose? It sounds like intelligence law.
Your Honor, I'm just trying to apply the Supreme Court's principal purpose or primary purpose.
No, I understand. How do you know whether it's 51% one thing versus 49% the other? Let's say we, for the sake of argument, we have something that everybody agrees is part administrative and part for prosecution. How would a court decide whether the primary purpose, and you don't have somebody coming in and testifying and saying, primary purpose was,
Yes, Your Honor. I think there's several factors that you can look to, and it's Section 40 of the Military Personnel Manual, which says that the very first document that's created is the muster report for accountability purposes. The second document is to provide the absentee report to dispersing for pay. So we know that while there may be some pay purpose later down the road, while there may be some EAS purpose down the road, the main reason why they are generating this document is to serve as evidence at a court-martial. Section 60 of the Military Personnel Manual also tells you that under the heading Critical Precaution, saying be careful when you generate these documents, legal men, staff judge advocates, because these documents will later serve as evidence at courts-martial, and we will need to rely on them. And that section further says that if you screw these documents up, we're going to lose courts-martial.
So the manual, you're saying that the manual indicates so, and the fact that there are other documents that do the heavy administrative lifting also suggests to you that...
That's right, Your Honor. And that's why in response to Judge Afford's question, that the muster report is likely non-testimonial because it is done for accountability purposes, whereas these documents are generated for later prosecution.
And I don't want to fill up all the time, but can you do 10 and 11, please, as well?
Yes, Your Honor. Prosecution Exhibit 10 is a return deserter message created by individuals acting in a law enforcement capacity up at Great Lakes Naval Base in Illinois.
How do we know that acting in the law enforcement capacity?
Well, Your Honor, it's the Naval Absentee, Deserter Absentee Collection. I apologize, I can't remember the formal name. NASIC is the acronym. And it is their principal duty to apprehend and to assist in the apprehension of deserters and those individuals in an unauthorized absent status.
And are all individuals in a UA or deserter status prosecuted?
Your Honor, it depends on the length of the absence, but by the time we get to the 8-day mark, as the first document that was admitted in this case, Prosecution Exhibit 8, the answer is yes. I mean, they face some sort of prosecutorial action, whether it is at court-martial or whether at a quasi legal hearing like Captain's Mast or summary courts-martial. So these documents are created to later serve as evidence at some criminal forum, whether it is court, NJP Article 15, or later at...
So did the Supreme Court want Crawford to apply to NJP?
I don't know, Your Honor.
Are you making that assertion here, that Crawford applies to non-judicial punishment?
I am not, Your Honor.
Okay.
Because certainly a broad array of hearsay can come in at non-judicial punishment. The point is the declarant's role. And would a reasonable declarant believe that this is going to be used for later use at prosecution? And if they're preparing that document for... principally for court-martial, but some of these cases, if it's a short-term UA, do go to the lesser form of non-judicial punishment and summary courts-martial. That would be testimonial.
Number 11.
Can we just go back to number 10 for a minute? Who is that message sent to? Who receives that message?
Your Honor, I believe it was the members' command, but I will check that.
My question is, the original message indicates it was sent to the same person who received it. The sender and the recipient were the same, and I'm just wondering who else gets it, which may give us an idea as to what the purpose of it is.
I'll have to take a look at that, Your Honor. I'll answer that question for you when I come back up for rebuttal. But I believe, if my memory serves me correct, that there was a number of recipients on there, including Appellant's Command, NASIC, the Personnel Department that Ms. Slocum works for, received that message from NASIC.
If all of those individuals or entities receive it, doesn't that take away a bit from your argument that it was made solely or primarily for court-martial purposes?
Well, Your Honor, the message in this case certainly has other purposes, which is to notify of several commands, and I think there's a laundry list on that email of individuals that are notified with that return deserter. But the primary purpose is to catalog that data, you know, when he was apprehended, by whom he was apprehended, and also when he began his period of unauthorized absence, so that the government could later walk into court and use that as prosecution exhibit 10. Prosecution Exhibit 11, Judge Baker, was created August 4th, 1993, 25 days after appellant's absence, and it is a DD-553 deserter warrant, which is issued so that local law enforcement can apprehend persons wanted by the armed forces. It describes past events. The role of the declarant here is again law enforcement. And there's a formal statement alleging that the appellant has begun a period of unauthorized absence. And the principal purpose of this has nothing to do with pay. It has nothing to do with accountability. It has everything to do with the capture of Agent 3 Rankin and his eventual prosecution. If there are no further questions, that concludes my argument.
Thank you. We'll now hear from the government.
The court, Lieutenant Craig Polson for the United States. First, you know, in answer to Judge Erdman's question regarding to whom the mail message is originally sent, it is sent to the personnel support detachment Pearl Harbor with information copies to the Navy Personnel Command in Wilmington, Tennessee, the enlisted personnel management command in New Orleans, DFAS, which is responsible for the pay of all service members, and FISC in Williamsburg, Virginia, which is another organization involved, I believe, with financial matters.
Well, hang on. What does what's personnel support detachment do?
That is the personnel support detachment, Pearl Harbor, Your Honor?
Sure.
They are the...
I know what DFAS is about, or not.
Personnel support detachment, Pearl Harbor, is the local administrative command that's responsible for all the handling of service members' pay and other administrative matters.
Okay, and what's... Millington is Naval Personnel?
Naval Personnel Command. That's the headquarters of the Navy Personnel Command for the entire Navy. And I'm not certain as to what the Enlisted Personnel Management Command in New Orleans, what their function is, but I believe it's another administrative command.
If this document were to alert someone that there might be the possibility for a court martial, which of those recipients is responsible for the military discipline side of this?
That would be handled by the command that the member is returned to, which would be...
Are they a listed recipient is another way of asking the question?
Your Honor, they are not a listed recipient on this message as far as I'm aware. I don't see them, they don't appear there anywhere.
Would this message be issued with respect to somebody for whom there's no intent to pursue any disciplinary action, that is, an individual is missing, and at some point they're listed as a deserter, etc. The individual comes back, There's an understanding on all parts that it was not an unauthorized absence. Is the same message issued, or is a different message issued at that point?
My understanding, based on the testimony from the personnel clerk that testified, Ms. Slocum, is that, well, I don't believe she was asked that specific question, is that every time someone that's in a deserter status is returned, that this message is generated. So the answer to your question would be yes.
We don't have, what I'm looking for are items in the record or a regulation on which we can take judicial notice as opposed to any general knowledge here. So that's your interpretation of the record, that this message would be used regardless of anyone's understanding of the underlying basis for the absence.
Yes, Your Honor, and that should be contained in Mopers Man 1600, in one of the subsections of Mopers Man 1600. The question, though, before this court is not whether this particular document in and of itself is testimonial, but whether all the administrative personal accountability records admitted to document the appellant's absence were testimonial and therefore violative of the Confrontation Clause of the Sixth Amendment. And the answer to that question, Your Honor, is no, because just as the record documenting the deportation and physical departure from this country of an alien is not testimonial, the personnel records documenting the absence and return of a service member are not testimonial.
Per se? What if the document said, this is a personnel record intended for the court-martial of Lieutenant Baker?
Yes, Your Honor. The Supreme Court has stated that business records are not, by their nature, not testimonial. And the reason that is because business and public records are ministerial objective observations recorded either in the ordinary course of a regularly conducted activity.
Is that really what the Supreme Court or this court said in Magyari, that business records per se are not testimonial? I don't think that's what either court said.
No, Your Honor. This court did not say that. And the Supreme Court said that business records are by their nature not testimonial. And the federal circuits that all have looked at whether business records are testimonial or not have stated that business records are not testimonial, and the reasons that I'm...
So you're saying that you'd like us to adopt a per se record, a per se rule here that no business record is testimonial?
No, Your Honor. This court should look at the tests outlined in the business record and the public records exceptions and determine whether there's any reason that this is not properly admitted as a business record or a public record. For example, if this matter was made solely for the purposes of law enforcement or a matter observed by a police officer, those types of things are not admissible as business or public records.
But doesn't that get us back to the Roberts analysis and gets us away from the Crawford analysis?
Yes, Your Honor, because these records are not testimonial, so therefore we do go to another analysis.
Are you suggesting we skip the Crawford analysis?
No, Your Honor. Once you determine that a statement is not testimonial hearsay, then the Supreme Court has stated it is not subject to the concerns articulated.
Then you're back to good old
Crawford.
But aren't we here to talk about whether these are testimonial, not whether...
Yes, Your Honor, we are.
Do you disagree with the criteria that the appellant has listed from Davis and from Crawford and from the other cases as to what we should be looking at to determine whether or not these documents are testimonial?
Well, Your Honor, the government disagrees with the appellant's test as being an overbroad test. The appellant would have this court deem all business and public records testimonial if they potentially could be used in a prosecution. That would make...
I don't think the appellant... I don't want to put words in either the appellant's mouth or your mouth, but I didn't hear the appellant say that they were not accepting primary purpose as part of the test.
Well, Your Honor, this court has previously held that the primary purpose for personnel records is not a law enforcement purpose, and if that is the test, whether the primary purpose of these records
I'm sorry, I got you off your flow. You were doing your factors. I was just testing whether you were accurately portraying, was trying to avoid straw men versus the factors identified.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, if you apply the appellant's test to Supreme Court's decision in United States v. Davis and Hammond, all of the 911 phone calls would be excluded regardless of the reason that the caller called in, because the caller in any of those phone calls would have to, a reasonable person calling in would know that they're potentially available for the purpose of use in a later prosecution.
Is primary purpose something we should be looking at?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. The primary purpose is important. And as Judge Baker was asking Lieutenant Meiser about, the factors that the court below applied, whether that they looked at in determining that these were not testimonial, that they were routine entries that chronicled the dates, times, and locations of appellant and his absence, that there was an administrative purpose for making these, and that the entries entered were objective in nature. Those are all important factors that show that this is not a testimonial document, but it's simply the recording of the ministerial objective observation of a fact.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor.
If it's a ministerial observation of a fact, why then do all of the documents utilize what are essentially words of art in the criminal law? For instance, Plaintiff's Exhibit 5 references unauthorized absence, which is an offense under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Prosecution Exhibit 6 again talks about unauthorized absence. Prosecution Exhibit 10 talks about deserter. And obviously, Prosecution Exhibit 11, it also talks about deserter. All of those are terms that are utilized in the criminal context. I'm not sure whether or not those are terms that are used administratively, and if they are, you know, what's their significance. But it seems to me that that adds a bit to the primary purpose argument of the appellant.
Yes, Your Honor. First of all, the military judge specifically instructed the members that the terms deserter and desertion should not be used as evidence that the appellant was guilty of the offense of desertion, and that they are administrative terms used by the military for someone who is in an unauthorized absence status for over 30 days. In addition, the status of being in an unauthorized absence status is not simply an offense under the military, under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. It is also important for recording the expiration of an enlisted member's obligated service. The service of when someone enlists in the military, they obligate for a specific term of years. And if when they are in an unauthorized absence status, that person is not earning what they call good time on their enlistment contract. The clock is stopped until they return again to military control, and at that time they're EAOS is extended out to...
But appellant would, I believe, have argued that that's true, all that's true. That's what the muster report and these other things did. This is piling on now. What's your response to that?
The government's first response to that is that in the record at page 406, Ms. Slocum testified that the page 6 purpose, or that the appellant's pay stops as a result of the page 6 entry. Therefore, this is not simply a side effect of making the page 6 entry. It's one of the primary purposes, or it's the primary purpose, the government would assert, for making this entry. Even in a case where someone is hospitalized due to their own misconduct or arrested and confined by civilian authorities, in those situations, there's also a page 6 entry made, even though those people are not termed deserters.
And page 6 in the government's view is the trigger then for the pay thing, not the muster report and not some other thing?
Yes, Your Honor, that is testified to at page 406 of the record.
Counsel, so in the government's view, if we were to conclude that the staff judge advocate's office, the legal office, has a prosecutorial function, something that we're not asking to concede, but let's just assume that at this point.
Yes, sir.
That the Navy could decide that in order to minimize the administrative burden of generating all these records, that anytime somebody doesn't show up, the unit can call the trial counsel's operation and report that, and that the trial counsel's organization will be responsible for generating all the paperwork, so that a phone call, as documented by the petty officer or any administrative personnel in the trial counsel's office, would be sufficient to prove the inception of an absence?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, the government would draw a distinction between the staff judge advocate and the trial counsel.
I understand that. I'm asking a hypothetical here, and that is based upon the overall question of where these documents are going and what they're to be used for. If the Navy were to decide that it's just too much paperwork going to these various offices, and since we know that many of these cases are going to be resulting in court-martial, we're just going to have that office, the trial counsel's office, be the one responsible for generating all the documents. Could the Navy do that?
Well, Your Honor, that is the reason for the law enforcement exception to the public records exception. The primary purpose of a police officer's job is to solve crime, and the primary purpose of a prosecutor is to prosecute individuals for committing offenses. And they are engaged clearly in law enforcement. Therefore, if they make entries or direct that entries be made, such as the nurse in Las Vegas v. Walsh case that the appellant cites. The prosecutor in that case directed the nurse to execute an affidavit stating that she did not use an alcohol swab in drawing the blood of a person that they were prosecuting for DUI. Because the affidavit was created solely for the purpose of use at
That's not my question. My question is, can the Navy designate the trial counsel's office to be the office that's responsible for generating all these records, records that would be used for administrative purposes as well as court-martial purposes? What's the government's position on that? That is, after we decide this case, if the government wins, can the Navy then say, well, we're getting rid of these staff judge advocate offices anyway. They're small and they're not very helpful, or we want to minimize their functions. And since so much of this business of unauthorized absence takes place with the trial counsel being in control, we're going to have them, for administrative convenience purposes, generate all the records. Could the Navy do that?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, the staff judge advocate's office is not where these documents are made. These documents are made by a personnel clerk or representative of the personnel support detachment in the transient personnel unit, which is a unit of sailors who are either arriving or departing the local area and maybe attached to a ship, or for a variety of administrative reasons attached to this command. But getting to your question, Your Honor, if the Navy were to designate a prosecutor to make an administrative personnel entry, and that then was their duty to do so as well, it would definitely be a closer call.
We have to issue an opinion here in this case, while we could. One option is to narrowly decide the facts are before us, but frequently appellate courts want to give guidance in an area where they anticipate further questions are going to arise. And one of the questions that's likely to arise in a very mobile military environment is, can the military, any military organization, designate the trial counsel's operation to generate all these records that will be used for administrative purposes as well as prosecutorial purposes? Does the government have a position on that?
The government's position, first of all, is that maintenance of personnel records is something that requires training and is done by personnel clerks. There are many different types of personnel entries, and training trial counsel to do all those entries.
I'm not talking about the trial counsel personally. At least the military organizations I'm familiar with have very highly skilled and competent non-commissioned officers and enlisted people who are fully capable of maintaining these records.
Yes, Your Honor, but every unit has an administrative detachment that maintains service records. But directly within the meaning of the public records exception, within the plain language of the public records exception, it states that notwithstanding the law enforcement exception, personnel accountability records, and service records are admissible under the public records exception. If, however, this court were to look at an entry that was made by a trial counsel or by someone that worked for a trial counsel, then it could also exclude that evidence if the court determined it was made solely for a prosecutorial purpose, or if the circumstances indicate a lack of trustworthiness, it still can be excluded under the rule. So the government's position is, while that theoretically might be possible, it's not something that's practical or it's not something that would per se guarantee that the record would be admissible.
Counsel, you keep going back to the public record and the business record exceptions to the traditional hearsay rule, but those rules dealt with the reliability of the evidence that was offered and did not address the testimonial nature that we now deal with under Crawford. So I'm not sure really how much support that gives you. There are different purposes for those rules.
Well, Your Honor, the very nature of business records and public records makes them not testimonial because they are a routine chronicle of dates, town's locations, or they have some other administrative purpose. Just as the person calling into 911 who's in danger, summoning the police to her house in order to save her, that purpose makes that statement that might otherwise be testimonial, not testimonial, according to the Supreme Court.
But
likewise.
But could a record that traditionally would be a business record, could such a record be testimonial under the tests that the Supreme Court has set out in both Crawford and Davis? Could a situation like that ever exist?
Well, as Judge Baker asked earlier, he asked whether if some random entry was made into a business record that had nothing to do with the business, or...
Let's say that it had everything to do with the business record. Let's say that it answered all of the questions exactly right.
Yes.
Could that ever be testimonial in the government's perspective? Or is there just a blanket exception, in your view, for business records from the...
No, Your Honor. If the circumstances indicate a lack of trustworthiness, then...
That's reliability. We're talking about testimonial issues here, not reliability. That gets back to the Roberts test.
Well, yes, Your Honor, but because these are objective recordings of fact, they're prima facie evidence of what's contained in them. And because they are made for the purpose of recording the activities of the business or recording something that a public officer has a duty to do, unless the sole purpose is law enforcement or to prosecute a crime, in those cases, those types of records are not admissible as business or public records because of a motivation. And motivation is a criteria that can affect whether something is testimonial or not, as the Supreme Court stated in United States v. Davis.
I come crashing through the gate, and the MP comes up and gives me a breathalyzer using Form 49 for breathalyzers, and will stipulate it's a business record. This is what they ordinarily use for doing this. Is that Crawford? Is there a Crawford problem there? They're not randomly doing breathalyzers. They do me, because I came crashing through the gate and plowed into the guard booth.
Well, Your Honor, that would definitely fall under the law enforcement exception.
And why might the government come in the next time and say, no, there's an administrative purpose. We need to decide whether he should have his license or not. We needed to document this because maybe they don't want him to have a license that's administrative.
Well, simply because the...
So, wait, first, is that testimonial or not?
That, because you have a military police officer making the entry, the situation is more of an adversarial situation, and the federal circuit courts have looked at the person making the entry and have stated that in situations like observations made by police officers and...
So it's fair to say that you may have a more contextual view than some... than perhaps suggested earlier. Are you saying... I want to ask you about Exhibit 11, so I'm trying to get off this question, but...
Yes, Your Honor.
You leave open the possibility that might be testimonial?
Based on the fact that then that would not be admissible as a public record because it's made by a police officer. Therefore, it clearly, it more impacts the concerns of the reasons behind the Confrontation Clause because it's an entry made by a police officer and it's an adversarial situation. Whereas the public officer recording the fact of...
Okay, I get it. Thank you. On Prosecution Exhibit 11, what's the non-law enforcement purpose for that? Isn't this something saying, pick this guy up if you get him?
Yes, Your Honor.
Sent out to, who is it sent out to?
It's sent from the generating command, as testified to by Ms. Slocum on pages 429 to 431 of the record. It's sent from that command to Navy Personnel Command. From Navy Personnel Command, it is disseminated, and the purpose of the...
It's disseminated to whom?
To various law enforcement agencies.
For what purpose?
To retrieve the member that is in a deserter status.
So it goes out to law enforcement officers to, in your word, retrieve the member.
Yes, Your Honor. And just like a warrant of deportation is not testimonial, this document should not be testimonial either. The typical reason for the arrest warrant to be deemed inadmissible is because it contains conclusions and other observations prepared by a police officer in order to generate probable cause. A deserter warrant doesn't contain those kind of things. It contains the fact of when the member left. It contains the fact that he's in an authorized absence status, but it doesn't contain any of these other types of observations that are typically contained in a regular arrest warrant. In addition, the government would submit that even if this document were admitted in error, it's harmless error because there's nothing in that document that's not contained in Prosecution Exhibit 8 that documents the member's absence and return to military control. If there are no further questions, that concludes my argument.
Thank you very much. Is there a rebuttal from defense counsel?
Judge Rimmon, in response to your question, I believe the government has correctly outlined the recipients on that message, and the recipient on Prosecution Exhibit 10 that will be responsible for assisting in the prosecution of the appellant is the Personnel Department. We see that on page 278 of the record, where NASIC actually separately sends the service record book, in this case, to the command. And from that point, the Personnel Department and the Statutory Advocate begin collaborating on the generation of several of these documents, specifically Prosecution Exhibit 7 and 8.
Counsel, which of these documents, if any, were generated by individuals working for or under the direct direction of a prosecutorial entity?
Well, Your Honor, Prosecution Exhibits 7 and 8 certainly were, because we have that in the record. We have that at page 291, where she's talking with the Statutory Advocate's Office, page 278, 292, 236, and I could spend the rest of my rebuttal time going through here of how Ms. Logan was cooperating with the Statutory Advocate.
But that's cooperation. To what extent was she either employed by or operating under their direction?
Well, those citations say that they are getting the information, or she is getting information from the Statutory Advocate, and they sent the service record book over to her to generate these documents. And so when the government says that this is different from Walsh, that is just categorically an incorrect statement of the facts of this record, because the personnel clerks, the legal clerks, whatever you want to call them, are working with the prosecutors in this case, or the Statutory Advocates who have the prosecutorial function within the military system. Page 6, or paragraph 6 of Prosecution Exhibit 10, which is that deserter message, also lists off the requirement that the recipients notify NASIC what happens, what court-martial happens, and the sentence that is awarded in that case, again implying that...
But it also says what discharge, so it contemplates something other than a court-martial, does it not, by saying NJP discharge, etc.?
Certainly it does, Your Honor. But I believe a fair reading from an eight-year absence is that this is going to be going to a court-martial. And from that document, you can infer that the primary purpose was to assist in the prosecution of appellant.
So you think Daniel Payne is responsible for exercising the prosecutorial discretion and the convening authority?
No, Your Honor. The convening authority has that discretion. And in collaboration with the personnel support detachment at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, they're generating these documents to later serve as evidence at appellant's court-martial. The First Circuit in the United States versus Mayer has held that a statement will be testimonial if the declarant can appreciate that the testimony is preserved for potential prosecution. And each of these documents meet that definition because the declarant could appreciate that these documents likely would later serve as prosecution exhibits.
If we apply that, then any unit that has a legal clerk that assists the commander in all of the commander's administrative and court-martial functions, that legal clerk couldn't be involved in preparing even a muster report. Would that be the case?
I think that's probably, respectfully, rather an overbroad statement of...
Okay, well, what is the defense position then as to when a legal clerk, which is a common function throughout the services, can or cannot participate in preparing the muster report and related documents?
I think it is one factor that this court should look to, which is the fact that that is a legal clerk, and then the other factors I mentioned previously, the primary purpose of this document, whether it's recording past facts. An example of a document that is non-testimonial that may have been created by a legal clerk or personnel clerk is Prosecution Exhibit 1, which is the enlistment contract. Now, when he's signing that enlistment contract and when that document is prepared, that individual may eventually someday wind up at a court-martial, but that's not the primary purpose that that document is being created. These documents were created to later serve as prosecution exhibits 6, 7, 10, 11, and therefore they are testimonial. Now, the government points to one point in the record at page 406 where Ms. Locum testifies that one of the documents, Prosecution Exhibit 6, was used for pay, and that is the one place in the 976 pages where you will find any reference to these documents being used for purposes of pay. But that statement is directly refuted by the Military Personnel Manual, which says that dispersing is contacted on day one, not day eight, when Prosecution Exhibit 6 is created to terminate appellant's pay. The documents in this case were testimonial, and appellant asks this court to set aside the findings and sentence.
Thank you, counsel. We thank counsel for both parties for their presentation today, and we will take a brief recess until 10 minutes after 10 when we'll reconvene for the second case. Thank you. Next case is United States against Simon, counsel for appellant.
Good morning, may it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Richard McWilliams, and I represent the appellant, Private Kevin Simon. The Court of Military Appeals, confirming its jurisdiction over the same appellants, defended this jurisdiction in United States versus Washington by emphasizing the provision of special safeguards. Among these safeguards, the Washington court relied, in part, upon the promise that, quote, the development of matters not raised at trial can be the subject of proper protection by means of the assignment of competent counsel to effect an on-the-spot and post-trial investigation on the accused's behalf. This safeguard, in Private Simon's case, broke down when his appellate defense counsel failed to contact him. This failure to contact Private Simon by his initial appellate defense counsel prevented that defense counsel from alerting the lower court that Private Simon had been diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder, thus raising a substantial question as to whether Private Simon had the requisite mental capacity to understand and cooperate intelligently in the appellate proceedings. Turning to this court's the first granted issue, Private Simon's ability to participate in his appeal in this capacity. Rule for Court Martial 1203C5 prohibits appellate authorities from affirming proceedings when the accused lacks mental capacity. In order to ensure that does not happen, Rule 1203C5 allows for the examination of the appellant by a 706 board. The standard for an appellate authority to grant or to order one of the 706 boards is whether a substantial question as to the requisite mental capacity to understand and to conduct or cooperate intelligently in the appellate proceedings has been raised as to the appellant. Private Simon now suffers from schizoaffective disorder and is on medication. Documents attached to the record by Private Simon's Appellate Defense Counsel have raised a substantial question to Private Simon's ability to cooperate in the defense of his appeal. These documents detail that specifically, since this court martial, Private Simon has experienced paranoia that someone would kill him, including his friends or family members, that he's lost a great deal of weight, that he swings from doorways for no reason, that he's been hospitalized 3 times, that he's cut his wrists, arms, stomach, and nose, that he's drawn a firearm upon his brother and put a gun to his own head, that he has difficulty sleeping at night, including going 3 or 4 days without sleeping, that he's experienced paranoia about his girlfriend being unfaithful. He's become withdrawn. He has felt that things on TV are actually happening. He's experienced delusion about a friend trying to come and kill him. He's been threatened by his mother. He's been arrested and placed in a mental facility. He's had a blunted affect and believed his brother has injected him with cooking oil. These documents, along with the affidavit of his guardian, his mother, Ms. Simon Blewett, along with the other medical documents.
Now, you say his mother was his legal guardian?
I said his
brief at page 5 says that appellant's mother is appellant's legal guardian. Is that established in the record?
No, that is not established. Ms. Simon Blewett's affidavit on page 1 declares that she is his guardian. She does not make a statement that she is his legal guardian, and there's no court documentation as to that. To the extent that appellant placed in his brief that she was his legal guardian, that was in error, Your Honor. Other symptoms of schizoaffective disorder, as displayed by attachment F, are that people that suffer from this disorder can feel constantly sad and fatigued, that they can be indecisive and unable to concentrate, that they can complain of various physical symptoms, lose interest in everyday activities, sleep and eat too little or too much, they have the potential for recurrent thoughts of death and suicide, sleeplessness, they can become agitated and distractible, susceptible to buying sprees, indiscreet sexual advances, and foolish investments. They can be compulsively talkative. They can be convinced of their own inflated importance, prone to cheerfulness, turn to irritability, paranoia, and rage. They can appear apathetic, have limited speech.
You've indicated there's a problem. What do you need to demonstrate to this court?
Well, the rule requires that we establish that there's a substantial question as to his ability to participate. We bear the burden of persuasion. These documents indicate that Private Simon has been diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder and displayed some of the symptoms raise a substantial question of his ability to participate in the defense of his appeal, Your Honor.
His appeal now? His appeal at the time the CCA heard it?
At the time the CCA heard it, Your Honor, most of the documentation provided details, him being symptomatic between the time of the adjournment of his court martial and the time when the CCA heard his case.
And what are you asking us to do, to decide that he did not have mental capacity at the time, to decide the CCA ought to look at this using their fact-finding power? What are you hoping we do?
Well, because of Issue 3, Your Honor, the appellant is hoping that this court dismiss the findings and sentence. However, failing that, the proper remedy would be to remand the case back to the Court of Criminal Appeals for them to use their fact-finding powers to determine whether or not a 706 board is appropriate.
And for us to remand, then, what do we need to find?
Well, Your Honor, both Lance v. Massey indicates that this court... It states that a court of military review at the time, a court of military review, or other appellate authority may order a 706 board. The appellant's position is that it is within this court's purview to order a 706 board. However, in Young, in 1995, CAF held that ordinarily, if that were the case, that this court would ordinarily ask the appropriate CCA to handle that. That is, if there's, I believe, from the case law, that the standard of proof is the same, whether or not there's a substantial question in order to remand the case back to the Court of Criminal Appeals. This court, if it believes the substantial question has been raised under Young and Massey, can order a 706 vote, although the dicta in Young indicates that ordinarily that would be something that would be remanded to the proper Court of Criminal Appeals.
Counsel, it seems there are two separate questions here. One is his ability to participate in this appeal at the present time, and second is, did he have the ability to participate in the proceedings at the Court of Criminal Appeals, addressing the question of whether there was competent assistance of counsel in that process and whether that issue of the mental competence was even brought to anyone's attention at that time. Which one takes precedence?
For this court, Your Honor, his ability to participate in this appeal, that must be, I believe, the foremost consideration of the court, because that's the stage that the appellant's case is in. In doing so, however, this court must also be concerned that appellant did not receive the statutory right to Article 6C review, which is a necessary precursor to affirming the conviction under 1203C5. The appellant's position is that this court should primarily be concerned about that, the deprivation of his Article 66C review at CCA, and should therefore remand the case back to ensure that the Court of Criminal Appeals is apprised of all the facts before affirming a conviction under Article 6 and RCN 1203.
So that would take primacy, that the court at this stage, in the defense view, cannot be confident that he received his Article 66 review, so that should take place before this court considers his competency to appear before us? Is that the defense position?
Yes, Your Honor.
Are you even challenging or raising his competency to appear before this court?
His diagnosis of schizoaffective disorder continues through to this day. Ms. Simon Blewett's affidavit was dated after the decision of the Court of Criminal Appeals and was delivered to his intermediate appellate defense counsel, we'll call her. Therefore, Private Simon, of course, has not participated in the defense of this appeal. The main brunt of this appeal, of course, is to make sure that he gets his first appeal, his appeal as of right with the Court of Criminal Appeals. To the extent that there's a substantial question raised, an outstanding substantial question as to his ability to participate in the defense of this appeal at this court, I believe, does have a substantial question as to his ability to participate. The main evidence that attached to the record and the main burden of the appellant's argument before this court today is that a substantial question has certainly been raised with regard to his ability at the lower court level.
Which issue would you like us to address initially, the 706 issue or the ineffective assistance of counsel? It seems to me that the ineffective assistance of counsel argument may come first, because if you prevail on that, it would get sent back for a new proceeding. And your argument in that is that the defense attorney did not have the knowledge to raise the mental competency issues.
Certainly, Your Honor, that would be the case. That if this court finds that the appellant received ineffective assistance before the lower court, that ineffective assistance applies not only to the appellant defense counsel's failure to raise these issues with regard to his mental capacity, but other issues that Private Simon may be able to provide to his appellant defense counsel. The appellant defense counsel, if ineffective, tainted the entire Article 6 proceeding, not just his the failure to raise his mental capacity at the time of the appeal.
And that would leave the CCA with the ability to determine what issues are under the parties, the ability to raise whatever issues they wanted to, and the CCA the ability to decide those issues.
Yes, Your Honor.
How would you deal with Strickland prong 2 if you don't know whether he had the capacity or not at the time under your scenario?
One moment, I'm looking at Strickland prong. I have it.
That's the prejudice prong of it. Aren't the two intertwined in some manner?
They are. They are inherently intertwined in that
Well, let me restate it another way. Just for the sake of argument, if the appellant were perfectly, there's no issue whatsoever, and there's no record, no nothing, he's fine. Would there be an IAC claim today?
Certainly on the second prong of the IAC argument, which is with regard to the failure to raise post-trial delay. But additionally, under Miller, arguably no, Your Honor, if there's no prejudice. If the appellant is not sitting at home waiting with some issue to relate to the Court of Criminal Appeals, then under Miller there is no prejudice. That would be correct. However, this case is distinguishable from Miller in that we have the appellant and his mother sitting at home in Columbus, Mississippi, with the appellant diagnosed with a schizoaffective disorder waiting.
I understand. I was asking a test question.
Accordingly, also the evidence submitted by the appellant in the form of the attachments indicates the need for a 706 period in that schizoaffective disorder is episodic and there's a frequent need for a change of diagnosis. Accordingly, the medical documentation provided by the appellant, while providing a snapshot in time of his diagnosis in, say, 2004 or 2005, it frequently changes. Accordingly, in order to ensure that at the time the Court of Criminal Appeals affirmed the appellant's conviction, that Private Simon did in fact have the capacity to participate, there would need to be a 706 board done contemporaneous with the Court of Criminal Appeals' review.
Where does this get you if you prevail on the 706 issue other than a continuance or delay in the CCA proceedings? You're not challenging his competency at trial, so that's not an issue. The issue seems to be whether or not he was competent to assist in the defense of the CCA. If the 706 board finds that he was not, then the CCA has the ability to continue that until at such time that he is, or if they find that he is, then that proceeds.
Your Honor, first it gets us procedural propriety. The rule for court martial 203 strictly prohibits the affirmation of a conviction while the appellant is unable to participate or lacks mental capacity. As appellate defense counsel, feeling that there's a substantial question, that needs to be raised before the Court of Criminal Appeals in order to ensure that their conviction is proper. Secondly, under Massey, the Court of Criminal Appeals, if it feels that there's a substantial question not only to the time of the appeal, but it can order 706 board into all three stages, his ability to participate at trial and his ability to understand and have the capacity at the time of the offense. The Court of Criminal Appeals and its fact-finding powers would have that authority once presented with this evidence that there's a substantial question raised as to his capacity. The Court of Criminal Appeals, with its fact-finding powers, has the authority to delve into those issues.
What if the remand said remand as to capacity during appeal?
Well, in that case, Your Honor, it gets its procedural propriety, the first prong, which is simply what every appellant deserves, is that under 1203C5, Private Simon's conviction was improperly affirmed while he was unable to participate. As an appellant under Article 6 and 1203, he's entitled to have be assured that his capacity is intact at the time of his the affirmation of his conviction, should that happen.
In that case, do we set aside the decision of the court below, or do we remand it for them to convene a 706 board and make a determination in terms of the following scenario? Let's assume that the 706 board would determine that he was competent at the time and the Court of Criminal Appeals would reach the same conclusion. Would there be any need for the Court of Criminal Appeals in that circumstance to do the Article 66 review all over again?
Yes, Your Honor. In affirming the conviction under 1203C5, the Court of Criminal Appeals has declared that they have conducted a full fact-finding review. If there's a substantial question raised, I believe, the appellant believes, that there needs to be then another review, another look, once they have been assured that that substantial question has been addressed, once they are assured under 706 or their own beliefs that question is no longer an issue. Any fact-finding or decision made without having that substantial question addressed is invalid and should be set aside.
Even if it turns that it's a substantial question, but it's one that would be rejected?
Yes, Your Honor. That's what that's what the appellate attends Rule 203 indicates, that, that if there's a substantial question, it need be addressed by the appellate authorities.
Right, but once they've addressed it, why do they have to then readdress their Article 66 decision?
They've addressed it
under this hypothetical. They've addressed it and assumed that it's not a valid concern, that he was competent at the time.
For procedural propriety's sake, Your Honor, because it's, and its first affirmation was simply done without having that question addressed, it's much as the same in the Jenkins cases where this court remanded a series of about 12 cases back to the Court of Appeals because it did not feel it was certain that proper 66C review had been undertaken. Having done that, it needs to be, those decisions need to be set aside and redone in order to ensure that that affirmation.
So if there's a question about ineffective assistance of counsel at the CCA, your view is if we remand it, we have to set aside the findings and sentence as well, even if the CCA would be empowered by our remand to determine that counsel was effective on appeal?
No, Your Honor. With regard to ineffective assistance of counsel, a simple remand back to the Court of Criminal Appeals, the setting aside the findings and sentence is something that appellant only asked for with regard to the third issue, post-trial delay.
Okay, thank you.
On the appellate delay issue, what was the delay between the convening authority's action and the docketing at the CCA?
572 days, Your Honor.
And in your view, was he represented by counsel during those 572 days?
Under Polinius, yes, Your Honor. He had trial defense counsel during that time.
He hadn't picked up his appellate defense counsel, but he had his trial defense counsel.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And do you think the delay, is there any explanation in the record as to why it took 572 days to move a document from one place to another place?
No, Your Honor. This is the complete record in the case of U.S. v. Simon.
And how long is the record?
It's 36 pages, Your Honor.
So how long it took the government 572 days to somehow get that? Where was the convening authority?
Camp Pendleton. It was across the country, Your Honor, in California.
Okay, so they could have biked it across the country, or they probably could have walked it. Do you think that kind of delay, is there anything other than ministerial action that is involved after the convening authority takes its action and the thing gets and subsequent to it getting docketed?
No, Your Honor.
In your view, is there something qualitatively different, or should there be something qualitatively different about that sort of delay when we look at ADP issues?
Certainly, Your Honor.
Now, I know you haven't made that argument, so I'm asking you the question now. In your brief, and you probably state you're applying the framework of the law, but the question is there something qualitatively different about that sort of delay that should cause this court or any other court to look at that element of the due process delay differently in terms of either analysis or remedy or some other manner?
Well, certainly, Your Honor, the egregiousness of that form of delay, the sheer lack of any cause in it, does reflect particular the term callousness comes to mind on the part of the government in protecting the appellant's due process rights. It seems to have simply disregarded them out of hand without regard to any. There's no real reason for it, Your Honor. So certainly the fact that mainly the record of trial and the documenting of it with the Court of Appeals, that was simply a matter of putting this in a manila envelope with maybe four stamps on it, that the government disregarded to do that for the better part of 2 years, that level of disregard for the appellant's due process rights to review, certainly that should be given heightened weight by this court.
Think about on rebuttal whether you think there should be adjustment, if at all, to the appellate due process analysis for such docketing delay. I know you just addressed it, but you're welcome to supplement that on rebuttal.
Yes, sir.
Counsel, is there anything in this record that indicates that trial counsel inquired about this case during that period of time, or contacted the appellant during that time, or was in any way involved with this case following the convening authority's action?
There is nothing in the record. The last mention of trial defense counsel was her decision to forego submitting clemency matters, and that is...
No, I'm talking about the trial... Well, yeah, okay, trial defense counsel, that's right. I'm sorry.
That was the last mention of her, so far as my reading of the record is concerned, is that her last appearance comes in the denial of submission of clemency, Your Honor.
Thank you.
In addition to post-trial delay, Private Simon is unable to have his application for Social Security benefits processed pending the issuance of his DD-214, and he and his mother continue to accumulate medical bills as a result of this post-trial delay. Accordingly, because of the post-trial delay in this case, the unique interplay between issues 1, 2, and 3 require that this court, the appellant asks this court dismiss charges due to the fact that should the appellant's case be remanded back to the Court of Criminal Appeals, the state indefinitely, should the 7-6 board come back that he is unable to participate, this will only further exacerbate the prejudice attenuated to the post-trial delay. Accordingly, the appellant asks for dismissal of the charges. However, failing that, the appellant contends that the proper remedy is to remand the case back to the Court of Criminal Appeals with an order to conduct a 7-6 board into his capacity to participate in an appeal, and then a new Article 66C review of the appellant's case.
Counsel, just so I can determine whether there's a disagreement between the government and the defense on one issue, and that has to do with the issue of mental responsibility. Does the defense disagree with the government's position that there was nothing in the record of trial raising the issue of mental responsibility in this case?
Nothing except for his conviction of willfully disobeying a superior officer and failing to train at CCU. However, there's nothing within the shell of the record during his province inquiry or whatnot that calls into question his capacity at the time of trial.
Or to put it another way, but for the post-trial evidence, would there be any ineffective assistance of counsel in this case by not raising the issue of mental competency post-trial? That is, in the ordinary course of events, the appellate counsel received this record of trial, had communication, and none of this other information came to bear. Would there be any reason for an appellate defense counsel to raise the issue of mental competency to participate in the appeal based on the record we have before us?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Was there any communication between the appellate defense counsel and the appellant prior to the filing at the CCA?
No, and according to this, it's affidavit, and again, I haven't spoken with the prior appellate defense counsel, but according to Ms. Lewis' affidavit contained within the record, the first communication between he, his mother, or any public appellate defense counsel comes roughly 2 months after the Court of Appeals has affirmed his conviction. If there are no further questions, that concludes my argument.
Thank you. Government.
May it please the Court, Lieutenant Jessica Hudson on behalf of the government. Appellant was not carrying his burden in this case to show that he lacks the mental capacity to cooperate and understand in his appellate proceedings, nor has he met his burden to show ineffective assistance of counsel. RCM 1203C5 states that in the absence of substantial evidence to the contrary, the accused is presumed to have the capacity to understand and cooperate intelligently in his appellate proceedings. Only if a substantial question is raised is a 706 board warranted. In this case, while appellant has demonstrated post-trial that he suffers from a mental disorder, he has not shown substantial evidence that he cannot cooperate or understand in his appellate proceedings. This case, Your Honor, is similar to the case of United States versus Young. In United States versus Young, the appellant requested post-trial that the case be remanded for a 706 board. In United States versus Young, the appellant was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder as well as schizoaffective disorder. This court found, in United States versus Young, that a letter from a civilian psychiatrist stating that the appellant currently suffered from a mental disease did not carry appellant's burden. In United States versus Young, there were no indications that the appellant was currently not competent to participate in his defense. Similarly to United States versus Young, appellant in this case has not shown any evidence that he is not currently able to assist, understand his appellate defense.
Well, what would he have to show? What kind of a showing would he have to make in order to meet the substantial evidence test, in your view, to have to carry the day as far as his lack of competence before the CCA?
Joyner, I think in the government's view, it would have to be something to show that he was not able to understand or cooperate at the time. I mean, what he has shown right now is the latest documents we have from the doctor show that he is alert and oriented, he's currently medicated, not suffering any thought disorder.
We're not talking about his competence now. We're talking about his competence during the pendency of the CCA. I guess between the commuting authority's action and the CCA decision, and the defense's argument that because of his mental issues, he lacked the competency to assist. And what does he have to show us in order for us to send it back to the CCA or make a decision here? You know, obviously you're arguing that he hasn't shown enough right now, but what does he have to show? What would it take?
There would have to be some documentation that he's suffering from hallucinations, they weren't controlled, that somehow his condition was not controlled.
And it's incumbent upon him to go out and obtain those at his own expense in order to trigger the military procedures for giving him a mental evaluation?
It's right. The burden is on the appellant to show that he's not able to assist.
So that is what is contemplated under the military procedure, that in order for an individual to avail themselves to the protections or to the 706 process, they're required to go out and at their own expenditure get an evaluation, which would then trigger the second evaluation.
Well, Your Honor, when they're on appellate leave, they're still able to seek services through the military, medical services. So at that point, it would not be at his own expense. It would be at the expense of the military to go out and get the documentation to show that there's something with his mental disorder that he's not able to understand or cooperate.
And what, in a case like this, where we're talking about a situation that is in the past, that his current, at least my understanding was his current mental competence wasn't a question. It was his competence at the time of the CCA decision. How does one go about getting a retroactive evaluation?
Well, Your Honor, due to the large delay in this case, it wasn't received at NMCCA until February 2005, which was after he was diagnosed, after he was medicated. It was after all of the documentation had been provided. It was not in the middle of his treatment.
Your response to Judge Erdman was that he was entitled to get the government to build his record or not as to whether there was substantial evidence. But the mother's declaration says that as a result of the illness, he wouldn't go on base because he thought someone would kill him. Now that either is, this is a mother who knows the law and knows what your arguments would be, or she's describing whatever this is, but how do you respond to that?
Well,
and that would seem to be suggestive of some problem.
Yes, sir, but two things. He should have been, and I don't know at what stage it should have occurred, but should know his benefits, his medical benefits, while he's on appellate leave, one of which is he's entitled to military service.
It's a catch-22, though, isn't it? If he's mentally incompetent but should know his benefits, or he's mentally competent. But how does he know if he's mentally incompetent? How you're still expecting him to know his benefits and to apply for all this stuff? Isn't that the problem? Let's accept that he is, let's take the hypothetical person, and we'll stipulate that they're incompetent. How do they successfully raise this issue after the fact?
You produce evidence right now to show that.
Okay, and so what is insufficient about the declaration of the mother and the notes from the doctors saying that during the time of his appeal, he had whatever this is, schizoid affective disorder, and we know that his condition is controlled with medication, but we don't know whether it was controlled at that time, if all we have is the declarations. Why is that insufficient to raise a question?
Well, Your Honor, we've got the declaration and we've got all the counseling services. And the first counseling services back from earlier in 2004 when he was having all of the paranoia described in the notes, it also states that he wasn't taking his medication at that time. In the final counseling note we have, it stated that once he starts taking his medication, he doesn't show any thought disorder. The doctor says, continue on your medication, come back in 2 months. The declaration from the mother also states that his condition is controlled with these medications.
I think the question Judge Baker's raising, how do we know whether those circumstances pertained at the time of his appeal? And I'll make this a two-part question, and that is, how does this dovetail with the ineffective assistance of counsel issue with respect to what would one would expect the normal interaction between counsel and an appellant is that when counsel's having these discussions, the counsel lets the individual know about the various opportunities to take advantage of what the military has to offer, and that when counsel's having a discussion with someone who may exhibit symptoms raising the question of competence, that the counsel is then the one who says, let me make the arrangements for you to be examined. And if you're not going to go on base, let's see what else the military has to offer off base. We don't have any of that here. So that's a long question, but I'd like the bottom line is asking you to address the relationship between the two issues, the competence at the time of the CCA and the question of ineffective assistance of counsel.
Well, Your Honor, I would argue that the competence has not changed from between NMCCA or here. All of the medical documents that are produced now were from the time before NMCCA even received the case. So all the evidence appellant has produced has been produced before NMCCA received the case.
And that was all before the NMCCA?
Well, Your Honor, it wasn't before the NMCCA due to the merit submission below, so the issue was not raised at NMCCA.
And do we know whether counsel reviewed that information and made a legal determination as to whether it was sufficient or not to raise the issue of competence?
It appears, Your Honor, that did not happen, since it appears that these documents were received by appellate defense counsel after the CCA's decision.
And as I read the government's brief, it's the fault of the appellant that he did not bring these matters to the attention of his counsel.
Well, Your Honor, it's not necessarily the fault of the appellant. If the appellant defense counsel had never contacted the appellant at the lower level, at the NMCCA.
However, then it's the position of the government that it doesn't matter because the NMCCA is capable of doing its review without any input of counsel.
Your Honor, the NMCCA is required to do its Article 66 review, which it did with the post-trial delay. However, there was nothing on the record to indicate that mental capacity of the appellant would have been an issue at that time. So therefore, NMCCA had nothing to review on this case for mental capacity.
Thank you.
In looking at Strickland in prong one, what's your response to the argument that a counsel who does not contact his client prior to submission to the CCA falls below the level of reasonably fallible attorneys?
Well, Your Honor, the government acknowledges that ethically an appellate defense counsel has the duty to, should always attempt to contact their client at the NMCCA level, at any level. However, the government's position is that it's not per se ineffective assistance of counsel under Strickland if they do not contact their client.
What about based on this record?
Based on this record, Your Honor, we've got a, it was a single specification at the lower, at the court martial for an orders violation, 36-page record of trial. It was a guilty plea, taking into consideration all the circumstances that surrounded the case at the court martial. We have a reasonable explanation for appellate defense counsel's actions in this case.
Well, hang on. Sorry, but did you say they had a duty to contact, but it's not ineffective?
Ethically, Your Honor, they should always contact.
So an effective counsel is one who acts unethically?
It's not per se ineffective assistance.
So they have an ethical duty to do something, but they're not ineffective if they don't do what they're ethically bound to do? That's the government's position?
Well, Your Honor, yes, ineffective assistance is a high burden.
Are you relying on prong two, or is this just on prong one?
I'm relying on prong two.
Oh, okay. So is the government conceding that the, well, I guess you're not conceding that. You certainly don't. It's the government's position in this case is, although the counsel acted unethically, they were effective on prong one.
No, Your Honor, they were not necessarily effective on prong one. However, you don't even have to determine prong one before reaching prong two.
How can you reach prong two without knowing whether the appellant was competent or not? At the very least, he's put something in play. It may not meet the standard. It's the government's position. It doesn't meet the standard at this stage to put it in play. But as Judge Efron's pointed out, counsel may have done something with that at the time.
Yes, Your Honor, but our government's position is that there's no prejudice to appellant either way. There's no reasonable likelihood of a different result in this case. If for instance, it was remanded for a 706 board, the result is to stay the proceedings.
And but the requirement is that the CCA cannot take action on a sentence without having a competent defendant before them. And that's the question that they've raised. And if in fact they're correct, then you know, then the CCA should not have taken action.
Yes, Your Honor. If this court finds that appellant has produced substantial evidence, then there's no choice but to remand it back for a 706 board. The government's position is there needs to be a certain level of substantial evidence, and that appellant hasn't reached that level with the 5 pages of counseling notes and the letter from his mother.
It's the government's position that counsel has an ethical duty to contact the client, the appellant, an appellant. Correct? This is not an IAC question now. Does that mean the government has taken the position that rights, waivers, and things are invalid and they're no longer in use?
No, Your Honor. The government's position is that the rights waiver plays into the circumstances, the totality of the circumstances surrounding the facts of a particular case.
I'm just talking about the ethical duty, not the IAC thing. You said, if I'm not mistaken, that the government's view is that there's an ethical duty on the part of appellate defense counsel to contact the client.
Yes, Your Honor.
If I maybe misunderstood, but the waiver thing, which is done at the trial level, says, I waive everything. Thank you, don't contact me again. Is it the government's position that those waiver things are therefore unethical and are no longer in use or should no longer be in use? Do you understand my question, at
yes,
least? It's a problem. It may be a hard question, but I want to make sure you understand okay. Where I'm going.
No, yes, sir. I understand the question. I think that the government thinks that the waiver should be in place. However, based on...
How can the government think the waiver should be in place if the government also takes the view that it's unethical to not contact the appellant?
Government takes the view that it's unethical to not contact the appellant based on case law set forth by this court, such as United States versus Miller, where this court has found that the appellant defense counsel should contact their client ethically. However, the government believes that the power of attorney done at the court-martial level is enough, especially in cases like this, where it was a single specification guilty plea with nothing on the record.
So the power of attorney takes care of that obligation? Is that your position? The obligation to contact the client?
In certain circumstances, Your Honor. It's the ethical duty of the appellate defense counsel to review the record of trial, and if there is something that raises the possibility of an appealable issue, it's their duty to raise that.
Well, we're talking about contacting the client prior to pursuing the appeal here. And if I understand correctly, what you're saying is that while this court has said it's the ethical duty of the attorney to do so or make every attempt to do so, that the power of attorney that the Navy routinely has their members execute takes care of that issue. If there's a power of attorney, they don't have to.
Your Honor, the government believes that the ethical duty, there's still an ethical duty to contact your client regardless of the power of attorney.
Okay, thank you.
So what purpose does the power of attorney have? Is it the... What's the government's view as to how we should address these? Should we address these powers of attorney in this case? Is that before us at this time?
Yes, Your Honor. In this case, I believe that it is. I mean, I believe that it is in all cases under the ineffective assistance of counsel claims, and it goes into the looking at all the circumstances surrounding a case.
Power of attorney permits the attorney to act in the case. Is there anything on the face of the power of the attorney which says to the client, goodbye, I'm taking this case, or the person who gets this case is going to do it, and we're not going to talk to you again? Is there anything that tells the client that they should have an expectation that the attorney will not attempt to talk to them?
No, I don't believe there's anything that specifically says you will not be contacted.
Okay, so is there any reason to view the power of attorney as doing anything more than permitting the attorney to act when the attorney cannot contact the client?
No, Your Honor.
Anything in the legislative history of those powers of attorneys that would suggest that it's anything more than that?
Not that I know of.
Thank you.
So the government's view is the ethical duty is a good faith effort to contact the client.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
Be very clear.
Yes, such as the United States v. Miller, where the letter was sent out. However, nothing was received in time, and he made a good faith effort to contact the client. Your Honor, in conclusion, the appellant in this case has not carried his burden to produce substantial evidence as required by this court in United States v. Young and as required by RCM 1203C5. Further, appellant received effective assistance of counsel under the Strickland standard. He fails to overcome the presumption, and any deficiency in appellant defense counsel's performance did not prejudice the appellant in this case. There are no further questions.
Question on ADP. Do you agree with the appellant's characterization that, one, this is a 36-page record of trial? Does the government agree that it took 572 days to get from the convening authority's action to the docketing?
Yes, sir.
Is that fair to say? Is there any explanation in the record?
There is none.
Does the government have a view as to how long, in ordinary practice, a 36-page record of trial should take to get from the convening authority to the CCA?
Government doesn't have an exact time, but it should not take long.
What's a reasonable amount of time? This is not... give me a box.
60 days. I'm not sure.
Okay,
it should not take long to get
let the record reflect. I'm not asking you to speak on behalf of the whole government here. I'm just trying to just get a sense from your what you know
it's
that I don't
that can
know.
It's done in office and should not take long to get to.
It should be measured in days.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your argument. Is there a rebuttal from the defense?
The government relies on its argument upon the case of United States versus Young. This case is inappositive for Young for the sole reason that in Young, the appellate defense counsel was seeking to have an investigation into the appellant's mental responsibility at the time of the offense. This case is different. The letters submitted by the appellate defense counsel in Young were in fact letters from psychiatrists. However, they gave current diagnoses, the diagnosis that, hey, at this time Young is suffering from schizoaffective disorder at this time. This court, in finding that that did not meet the burden as to raise a substantial question, found that the reason that those letters didn't meet that burden was because they dealt with the diagnosis as of now, as opposed to his lack of responsibility at the time of the offense. Young really only addresses the fact pattern that appellant is in right now briefly in saying if the appellant were asked and asked to remand the case for an examination into his ability to participate in his appeal, we would ordinarily remand that to CCA. With regard to, I just briefly want to touch on the post-trial delay issue in that the government contended, albeit off the cuff, that it would take about 60 days, or that'd be a fair amount of time.
Well, in fairness,
I'll let that go.
Okay.
In conclusion, because the appellant's case is different than Young, and there is substantial rules and case law on this question, because the appellant has met its burden to raise a substantial question which is ability to participate in the appeal, and due to the overwhelming post-trial delay in order to perform just a ministerial act, this court just set aside the findings and sentence. Failing that, procedural propriety and the assurance that the appellant is afforded his due process right to Article 66 review requires this case be remanded back to the Court of Criminal Appeals. There are no questions. That concludes my argument.
Thank you. We thank both parties, counsel for both parties, for your presentation today. That concludes our arguments for the week. Thank you.